I think the biggest ethical quandary lawyers are facing right now is communication with their clients. You are very much on top of your clients. Let's talk about that. What's your approach to this?
So I think organization is key, especially on the plaintiff side. Defense side, it's important based on caseload, reporting to clients. On our side, it's even more important because on the plaintiff side is when you actually run the risk of misconduct, whether it's intentional or unintentional. And the unintentional falls on neglect or lack of communication. If you're neglecting your cases, you can get in trouble.
Sure.
If you're not communicating with your clients, you can get in trouble. So since day one coming over here, I've had my Excel spreadsheet. I keep a log of last time I talked to each client, and I make sure I want to update that about every 2 weeks. And it could be simple. It could be a text message. It could be a phone call. But either way, I need to let my clients know that I haven't forgotten about you. I'm working on your case. Here's a little update.
Welcome to Above the Legal Limit. I'm your host, Justin Chopin, business owner, lawyer, dad, world's best husband, traveler, and adventure seeker. On this podcast, we mix business with pleasure. We'll dive into growth strategies, entrepreneurial adventures, the business of law, and prove that business isn't boring. So let's get ready because we are going above the legal limit.
Welcome to Above the Legal Limit. Big guest here today. All you listeners out there, hold up. We've got Frankie Cannone here on the show. How you doing, Frankie?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Frankie has been with us for, I want to say 18 months.
Yeah.
Is it?
Less than 2 years. That sounds about right.
When did you joined us in 2023?
April of 23.
I'm going to say you're, you know what? I don't know about you.
We're almost there.
I think it's 2 years.
Works for me.
January's over. So, and now this will get, I don't know when this is going to get published because they have to curse, you know, I have to bleep out all the times I curse and it takes them a long time. So January's over. February is like a blur, right? Because yeah. It's Mardi Gras. We're here. We're just drunk in the street. Not wearing clothes. So February is a blur. March is a work month. Everyone knows, like, March, it's a long month. You got 31 days. On the defense world, when I was a defense lawyer, you just build your ass off in March. So March is over. So we're in April. So you've been here for 2 years now. Frankie is our go-to experienced trial lawyer, and we're very blessed to have him. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we... By way of introduction to Frankie, we learned through trial and error when we talk about like getting the best talent. And I love all the people that have worked with us. So if you're out there and you're like, hey, that son of a bitch, what's he saying? He fired me and now he's talking bad about me. No, I love all the people that we've worked with. But we have learned over the years that we have like a core requirement to work at the Chopin Law Firm. So you can't just like come in the door and be like, look, I graduated from law school. And they gave me this license, and I want to work with you. And I'm going to say, no, you have to go to a defense firm. And so now that's like a core requirement. And we always, like, we had danced around this issue, but Frankie kind of really solidified it for us because you and I, we share a very similar background. So how long were you on the defense?
Defense, I think I'd say in total, probably about 5 years.
5 years. So I think that's the requirement.
Yeah,
because it takes you 5 years to be truly miserable in your existence. And if you haven't been miserable in your existence as a lawyer, then you're not even a lawyer then. I don't know what you are. Yeah. If you haven't sweated it out, if you haven't looked at the clock at 6 o'clock and said, shoot, it's late, I want to go home, but looked at your hours and your hours weren't 8.3. Right? Your hours were maybe like 7.6. 7.6, and you're not taking off Christmas Day. 7.6, you're working on Christmas, right? So you got it. It's 8.3, or is it? Or is it 8.3 for 2,000 hours?
We shot for 9.
Okay. So, right, because you, like many Americans, enjoy the celebration of the holidays, whatever it might be, and you want to take a day off around Christmas or, you know, Hanukkah, you're going to need that extra 0.7 hours. If you haven't done that, then you don't understand the pure luxury it is to, you know, be in charge of your own time, your own calendar, and your own destiny. And you can truly, like, you know, be in charge of your own self. And so, because the billable hour is what keeps lawyers on task, right?
Yeah.
So you may, at that 6 o'clock hour, and you need another hour's worth of work where... you know, if hours didn't matter, you would just go home, right? Yeah. So if you're a government job, you just go home. That's why the government moves, you know, like molasses. But like if you're in private practice, no, you got to do the work. And so it's very difficult for plaintiff's lawyers. So plaintiff's lawyers have a habit of being like bad because they leave at 5 o'clock and they go play golf on Fridays and they want to fish on Wednesdays, right? Not us. We all know who I'm talking about. Those guys are out there. And so that doesn't yield the best results. So we found, so when Frankie came on board, it was the first time in a long time where the firm leaders and myself all agreed, are like, hey, this guy works like we work. And the reason is because it was beaten into you, you know, and hey, any way or another. So now that you're 2 years into it, let's talk about it. So what are some differences? What do you think of representing plaintiffs instead of insurance companies?
Sure. So I thoroughly enjoy it because it kind of gets you back to interacting with the people. And, you know, it's all different for everyone, but part of the reason why did you become a lawyer? You want to help people. You want to use the knowledge you learn in law school and through other jobs to assist and help people, especially in their times of need. So jumping back over, or for the first time, plaintiff side, you get to kind of interact and have that human interaction again because you're actually helping people.
Right.
Sure, it's great helping an insurance company save money, defend a case, fight the good fight, all that stuff. The human interaction, talking to the individual, experiencing what they've experienced, hearing about how their life is upside down, they're dealing with pain, they've been wronged. Getting to help them, that's really been probably the best change over that side.
I liken it to being a little bit like a country doctor in a lot of ways, right? And so clients will call us up and they'll be like, I have a problem. And you'll be able to sit there on the phone with them and say, okay, let's talk about it. Like, what's going on? You know, and you, through your practice, your trade, your education, you know, we become like expert problem solvers. We're able to like sit down and distill the issues and come up with solutions. And a lot of times, yes, we're able to, you know, help our clients that are injured, but there's on a granular level, it's really like you get the joy and the benefit of like really trying to help somebody with, you know, your education and training. And it may be that they're injured, you know, but sometimes it's not even like sometimes people will call me up and they'll say this horrible thing happened to me. And I'll be like, oh my goodness, let's talk about it. And it's not a case. It's like not a case that we can handle. Like I can't handle every case that comes to the door, but I'm able to explain to them, you know, in a real way, like this is what's going on. Right. And this is why this is happening. This is what the law says. And so I don't think you have a case. I'm not just going to blow you off. What I'm going to do is I'm going to explain to you why. And then afterwards, you know, a lot of times these clients will be like, oh, my God, you know, no one's ever taken the time to talk to me like that. No one's ever taken the time. You know, even doctors don't do it anymore, right? They come in, right? You got, especially if you're like a specialist, you're like the ENT's got like 50 appointments in like a 30-minute slot. They come in, they look, they do this, they do that. They go, all right, you write your script, they're out the door. And if you have a question, like you can be like, any questions? But they know, like you know, like the question is like, do you have any questions? The answer is no, right? Yeah. Like then if you say yes, they're like, the guy's like, yeah. All right, what's up? You know, they're all pissed off. So, you know, being able to give people your time and your expertise, I think there's reward there.
But I think also part of it's going back to the billing. You're not tied to billing, so you have the time to help people. It's not all at the end of the day is like, how many hours have I logged? Shoot, got to get it up. You have the time to actually focus on the law, focus on the skill set you've acquired over time, and actually have the time to help people.
Yeah, right. And it's result oriented too, right?
Always.
And so on the defense, the result that I'm aiming for may not be like a true victory, right? It's not like TV. It may be like, well, I think you got about a couple million in exposure. Let me see what I can get it for. Yeah. You know, and then you can go back to the client and be like, hey, I got it for like, you know, $850,000. And everyone's like, oh my God, you're a hero, right? Yeah. And like, you're not. Like, there's not any result there. All I did was shave off, you know, some potential exposure by making the other side jump through hoops that they didn't want to jump through.
Yeah.
You know, and so. So I think it's nice. It's nice being a plaintiff's lawyer. It's nice helping people, and it's nice working for a result, right? Yeah. And so you can build the widget, and then you can see it at the end, and then there's reward in that. You know, I like it. Now, you, much like me, also are not new to the practice. So you grew up in the practice.
Correct.
So I was the 16th lawyer to be sworn into the bar in my family. We Chopins have no imagination whatsoever. We only know how to do one thing. My wife became the 17th member, and we're waiting to see like which of the next Chopins. Now they're all young still, but like I'm pretty sure we've got at least two, possibly three more lawyers, and maybe four. I don't know. It's terrifying. I'll be very old then, and so it won't matter. But so you have a similar background. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're not at 16 or 17, but I think I was the fourth.
There you go. Well, so thank God.
Yeah, I mean, right?
Who so, is?
Started off with the grandfather, my mother's father, and then my mother and her brother, my uncle. And so some of the earliest memories I had of my mother, who was a career public defender, would be her at our dining room table, just covered in legal pads, binders, preparing for case. As well as seeing her, you know, kind of storm around the dining table, pacing back and forth, working on her opening statement or closing statement. And being the mama's boy that I am, you know, I was just drawn to that.
Right.
So watching her, thinking, you know, she's the coolest person in the world and what the work she was doing, I was like, that's exactly what I want to do. And that's what kind of also started me as starting out as a prosecutor and doing criminal law. So I was very fortunate to have that kind of influence because, I mean, my mom, I mean, she's a rock star. She's a legal encyclopedia. Like, I leaned on her heavily as a prosecutor. I still continue to lean on her as far as, you know, her experiences. And even though it's a different state, different laws, you know, at the end of the day, rules of evidence, rules of procedure, as well as
right.
ethics.
Some things are just kind of exactly. universal, right?
So I've been very fortunate in that regard.
So, but, and she, I don't know if you said this or not, but she, so she's no longer a public defender. So correct. She's a judge now, right?
Correct. So she's been a judge for a bit now.
And we don't, we're not going to get into it. We don't need to get into it. But my, it's my understanding, like a pretty high profile.
She's had some cases on her docket. That
yeah. Some national attention. Yeah. Interesting. So, yeah. Well, you know, my experience growing up in the practice is a little bit different. My mother and father were both attorneys. But I was never present for, you know, dad, like, with legal pads and all that. What he would do was like, he would stay up all night long dictating. And so my earliest memories of this is laying in bed and, you know, like kids, like when we were kids, we always slept with our doors open mm-hmm. because we're always afraid of something. And so you could hear it. And so he'd be sitting there at the table dictating. And it's just like this, you know, my sisters and I have the same memory. And I can hear him, you know, like kindness, personal regards, you know, like he's just dictating letters, you know, at the dining room table. I don't even know what time it was. I was a child. It probably wasn't nearly as late as I thought it was, but hardly transformative. Like you're not like, that's exactly what I want to do. I want to dictate letters until, you know, somehow. So I was like, that's what ended up happening. Like, I'm going to dictate letters when I grow up. Yeah. That's what, you know, thank God we don't do that anymore. But so that's cool. It's interesting. That's a different dynamic to the practice, you know, be able to watch someone prepare for trial, you know.
Which is very fortunate because, again, you know, the profession's getting away from trials. It's something crazy, yeah. like 99 point whatever, settle before. And it's really in the criminal sphere that, you know, you do go to trial. There are trials going on. So my whole perception of a lawyer growing up and that I wanted to embody was a trial lawyer. Be in the courtroom, argue your cases, be before a judge, a jury. And so that's kind of really been the most influential aspect that I've had throughout the years of my mother.
Well, and so it's important for us, too, because this is sort of how we bill ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. We are trial lawyers. Every case that comes in the door from day one, we are looking at it from the perspective of the trier of fact, may it be that a judge or jury. So that what that means that, like, you walk in the door and you tell me your story, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, what's my theme of the case? Mm-hmm. What's the best way to portray this? What, you know, what are my good facts? And how do I want to shape those good facts in a narrative that I think people will really can grab onto? And then, like, what are my bad facts? Like, all right, what's awful about this? Well, you cut through four lanes of traffic. I don't love that. But how can I get ahead of it? Well, maybe let me think about it. Like you're in the shower now. Like you're taking a shower and you're thinking about your, you know, your arguments or your examinations. Well, maybe he didn't cut across four lanes of traffic. He was merging. You know, hey, yeah. Who here doesn't merge yeah. onto I-10? Right? Like you got to get on there somehow. And that's what we do, right? And so every case that comes in the door, that's how we treat it. We had a big meeting yesterday, and the outcome of the meeting was we want to be trying more cases.
Yeah.
It's not that simple, because you just said, right, 99.9% of the cases, like, they settle before trial. So our big initiative in the next year is, like, we want to isolate, you know, a couple of cases. You know, everyone's going to sit down and we're going to go through them, and we're going to isolate a few cases and say, okay, which of these cases do we think, you know, we should be trying? Because here's the thing that happens. Another lawyer said this to me, and I thought it was really well said. We end up settling the cases we should try, and we end up trying the cases that we should have settled, right? Not every case needs to go in front of a jury. Like, right. That would be a nightmare. One, it's cost prohibitive. It's time, you know, it takes a lot of time. But also, if I'm getting a good result for my client, and I know maybe that there are some bad facts to my case, you know, I can sometimes look in that crystal ball and say, jury's going to hate this. Yeah. This is a good settlement. These are some bad facts. You know, maybe there's a slight discount. Maybe there isn't. Sometimes there isn't. Sometimes Phil settled one yesterday with a ridiculous result. I couldn't believe when he told me the result of what he did. He tell you this?
No. Oh, what?
Ridiculous. Yeah. We're not going to go into it. But, you know, huge result for this client. Huge result. I don't even think a jury would have given him that. So, you know, by the way, I call him Limits Lurio. So not every case needs to be tried. But we're going to treat it like it is, yeah, because you don't know, right? We never know. And also, you know, cases have a way of changing, right? So sometimes a case long comes in the door and we don't love it. You know, it's like, well, I'll try. Let's see. You know, let's get to work on it. And then it becomes just this monster of a case. And it becomes a great case, right? And then sometimes this case walks in the door and it is like the unicorn, right? She is the perfect case. And about 6 months into it, you realize, oh, man, this case is garbage. Every single thing that we thought about this was wrong. But, it, you know, so now what? Now what do we do? So it's a balancing test of trying to find out, like, which are our good cases. So from your perspective, you know, that's where our mind is, and that's what we're focused on. We want to find the right ones, and we want to get out there and we want to try it. But it's not easy. Nobody wants to try the case. Yeah. But you know, that is always the leverage that we have, right? That's without that leverage, insurance companies will roll all over us.
You have to be comfortable in a courtroom and you have to be willing to take the case to trial.
Right. And you know, when I did defense work, I knew there were insurance companies out there that would track, you know, plaintiff's lawyers and which ones would try cases and which ones won't. And it was actually my first report ever to the initial report. I would always be like, so-and-so is, you know, the plaintiff on the case. I do not think he has any intention of trying this case. I do not think he has the ability to try this case. Client, and then, you know, so I talk all about the plaintiff's lawyer. Then I talk about the plaintiff. You know, I'm like, you know, this would be after the deposition, right? After the first deposition. Yeah. And you do the whole thing. You're like, I think it's a really good, favorable plaintiff. I think you need to be aware of it. I think likable. You're right. You got your sweet old lady that got rear-ended. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a problem. Everyone's going to love that, you know, the Nana is there, and you know. But sometimes they're not. They're like, this is the worst client. This jury's going to hate this guy. He's not like rude. Credible. He's crude. Yeah. He's, you know, he looks squirrely. He's sweating the whole time, right? Like all the things you can imagine where like a jury would hate that, right? So, you know, but the insurance companies, like, they know if you're going to try a case or not.
Yeah.
And so you almost have to do it. In this game, you know, otherwise, you like I said, you're just going to get rolled over.
Absolutely.
So I think the biggest ethical quandary lawyers are facing right now is communication with their clients. I've noticed, so I've come in and out of every case and team here, that you are very much on top of your clients. Let's talk about that. You know, what's your approach to this?
Yeah, so I think organization is key, especially on the plaintiff side. Defense side, it's important based on caseload, reporting to clients. On our side, it's even more important because on the plaintiff side is when you actually run the risk of misconduct, whether it's intentional or unintentional. And the unintentional falls on neglect or lack of communication. If you're neglecting your cases, you can get in trouble.
Sure.
If you're not communicating with your clients, you can get in trouble. So since day one coming over here, I've had my Excel spreadsheet. I keep a log of last time I talked to each client, and I make sure I want to update that about every 2 weeks. And it could be simple. It could be a text message. It could be a phone call. But either way, I need to let my clients know that I haven't forgotten about you. I'm working on your case. Here's a little update. And I think by communicating, you're also putting your eyes on your client's case. And that's how you prevent things from slipping through the cracks and getting into trouble. So as far as it relates to ethics, it's just communicate. Communicate with your clients, communicate with your team, make sure everyone's on the same page, and constantly moving your case towards resolution.
I can't agree with that more. We text our clients, we call our clients, we email our clients sometimes. They text us. I think it's just this constant challenge to always keep everybody abreast of all the developments. I've had to say it to clients too, with clients that are, you know, they're worriers, right?
Yeah.
And I get it. I understand. Not because I've been in your shoes. I understand because I've represented thousands of clients that are in your shoes. I understand when you say, like, I know why you're calling me. I know you're worried about your case. But I have had to tell clients before, like, listen, you're calling me with a frequency that's preventing me from working on your case. So if you call me every day to ask me about it, you're kind of eating into the time I have to do it.
Yeah.
Also, I have other clients too, right? You're not the only client, right? That was, in addition to trying cases in the next year, another big goal for us is we're always trying to think, you know, in terms of operations of what can I do to communicate more with our clients?
Yeah.
All we did yesterday, we just took the whole day off and we just sat there and strategized on like what are some things we can do? And so I think we have some pretty fun, exciting things we're going to unroll this year. Roll out this year. We have the some new software we're going to implement that's going to send clients videos about, you know, the various phases of their case so that, you know, when they have a deposition coming up, it'll be like a video of me. They're like, hi, I'm Justin Chopin, and I'm going to talk to you about your deposition. And it's like, maybe it's kitschy, but it's like another touch point to let them know, like, hey, you're not being neglected. We are 100% on your side. Our fates are tied in together.
Yeah.
And here's a video you can watch all about it to tell you more. So I think that's it's one piece of the puzzle that we've been working on for about a year that should probably in the next 90 days will be fully onboarded. And then we talk about what do we do? You know, sometimes cases are parked for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And sometimes it has nothing to do with us. It may be that there's just discovery that needs to take place that doesn't really involve the client. And I can't get a trial date until the discovery's done. And I really need the other lawyer to do the discovery and I can't make him or her do it. And so what do we do with these clients? Like, you know, these guys that are parked for a little bit and we haven't forgotten about them. But, you know, and so our goal, and that's one of the things we're working on behind the scenes is, like, okay, what can we do to give these clients peace of mind that we have not forgotten about them? And that's a real challenge. But for them, the only thing we could come up with is, well, we're just going to have to call them.
Yeah.
You know, put them on a spreadsheet, print it out, and go down the list. And one by one, you know, of these clients, and make sure that we're touching base with every single client we have every single quarter.
Yeah.
And if we need to hire more people to do it, then so be it. But they need to hear from us. You know, I think at least every single quarter.
Yeah, and I mean, whether it's, you know, you're waiting on the discovery process or perhaps a court-appointed neutral to set a mediation on a hurricane case or whatever it may be, I mean, currently my practice is I'll reach out to them. I'll let them know when the deadline is for them to discover, but also to let them know, you know, even if they don't produce it at that date, we then got to do this 10.1 conference, which then grants them courtesy 2 weeks, which then we file if they don't, which could take the court some time. So I'm always of the idea that giving them the information on the front end helps on the longer delays. So then that way you can reference back, hey, no, remember I said this could take some time. Because if you're not communicating with them on a regular basis, and let's say a month has gone by, 2 months has gone by, you know, whether or not what you're telling them may be true, they may not receive that information as, you know, being true. They might think you're pulling their leg or come up with an excuse. So front-end communication, I think, is key to prevent that.
Well, and it helps you learn more about your case, right? So, you know, if you're not communicating, you talk to them and they say, well, this has happened before where you call them up. And it was like, how's your treatment going? They're like, well, I stopped going.
Yep.
Like, what do you mean you stopped going? I stopped going. Why'd you stop going? And, you know, the defense lawyer will say, well, they stopped going because they're not hurt,
mm-hmm.
right? But if you really want to ask the question, they'll say, well, you know, Justin, my car broke down. My girlfriend was supposed to drive me out there. But she and I are kind of, you know, having a little problem right now, and I just don't have a way to get to the doctor. And now, if I never called the client, their case is toast, yep. right? I mean, like, if you stop going to treatment, the consensus among everybody, I don't care who you are, if you don't go get treatment, then that is interpreted as saying you're not hurt. Now, I know that is not true,
yep.
right? I hurt my back, I used to complain about it all the time. My wife finally said, if you do not go to the doctor, I do not want to hear another word about your back. So either go to the doctor, you know, and then you can continue to complain. And if not, shut up, you know, was basically the basic sentiment from my wife. And I understand, like, you know, she was right. Like, I had to go to the doctor I got a back, you know, my back's not great. But that's real life. Like, I don't, you know, why didn't I go to the doctor? Cause I'm busy. Cause I'm running a practice. I got two kids, you know, she works, I work. There's a million things going on. Right. And I'm no different than our clients. Our clients are just like me, right? They're busy. They have lives, they have jobs, they have relationships, they have car problems, yeah. just like I do. And so I got in the car the other day and a light came on I've never even seen before. I Googled it and Google was like, yeah, that's no good, man. You don't want to see this light. But courts are unforgiving in this. And so you should be able to say, well, I didn't go to the doctor because I didn't really have a whole lot of time to go to the doctor. No, nope, that's no good. You know, it's the truth. Doesn't mean you're not hurt. No, but you're not going to get any leeway with it. So, but had I not called the client, it would have been disastrous for the case. You know, now I'm able to say, well, geez, Bill, why didn't you call me?
Yeah.
Let me reach out to the doctor's office and see what they suggest. And the doctor's office is like, well, we have transportation. Why didn't you say so? I'm like, well, because I didn't know so. Right?
Yeah.
So this, by staying informed with our clients and their life and what's happening, we have the ability to help them to generate the best result for them. Right. And so if I had just ignored the client, maybe their case is worth a couple $1,000. Mm-hmm. But now I'm able to help them out. Now they've got transportation. Next thing I know, the doctor's telling me, hey, Justin, this guy's really hurt. You know, this guy, I think he needs an MRI.
Yeah.
I'm going to write him an order. Y'all, if you want to send him out, you know, I'll leave that up to you guys. Now we're talking about something else. Now we're talking a completely different kind of case. But in the end, it's the communication with the client that really overcame, you know, the possibility of a bad result versus a good result.
Yeah.
So, how often do you talk to all your clients?
So I have a spreadsheet, and so I'll go down the list and I will make sure I'm talking to all of them, and I always update it. And once it starts to get a little long in the tooth, I'm like, I gotta talk to this person. I gotta reach out. I gotta send a text message, call. So I try to make sure staying, because I mean, we are a service based practice. We are providing a service, and we are trying to do the best for our clients, and you can't do that if you're not communicating with them.
No, I agree. I think, you know, that gets lost. We say it a lot around here. It gets lost on really on the plaintiff's bar a lot, you know, where it's they're lawyers aren't always customer focused. You know, they view their customers as clients. And when you call someone a client, it's a little bit, I always liken it to calling someone a patient, right? So patients don't have good customer service. When's the last time you had like good customer service as a patient,
yeah.
right? You get told when to show up, on what day and what time. And you're like, nobody, when you go to the doctor's office, right? Like nobody's like, all right, everyone get out your calendars.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and let's see what's a good time for this next checkup. Well, no, doctor, I got trial. Right, that's not how it goes, right? No, you get told, well, you got to be there at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. That's it. That's what they got. So you get told when to show up. You get told where to go. You get told what to wear. They're like, all right, take all your clothes off. You're like, what? And we're like, yep, take them off. Take it all off, you know? And you're like just standing there naked. And you're like, okay.
Weird dentist visit.
Right. I was like, this is odd for a dentist. This is peculiar. Right. So you get told what to wear and what not to wear. And they're very like cold and calculated, right? It's a very sterile environment, right? From the tile up to the walls to no, I love doctors, and this is a nature of what they're doing, right? So, lawyers can have a way of treating clients like this, right? And so it's like you get told when you can talk to me, and don't call for questions, and I'll tell you when I'm ready. And there's nothing to report, and don't call me, I'll call you. And it's too complicated, so I'm not going to explain it to you anyway. It's like, don't worry about it. and you start getting treated like a patient. I don't know, if you ask around, no one, I'd love to hear if there's someone out there that's like, I went to big hospital and just had the best experience, right? Like I really had the best time.
Yeah.
There was a piano player in the lobby, right? I mean, I just thought, what a lovely day out. It was, you know, right. So what do we do? Like, you know, so I think that what we do is we remember what it is to be a consumer and a customer, and we're always thinking here, like, what would be the best for them? Well, maybe it's checking in. Maybe it's texting instead of calling, or maybe it's texting instead of emailing. Or maybe it's, you know, now we do a new thing where if you're having surgery, you know, we'll send you a care package. We'll send you soup, mm-hmm. Right? And it's just being nice, you know. Yeah. It's just to kind of let our customers know that, hey, I don't view you like a patient. Like you're not just a client where you're going to get told when to show up and when to leave. That we are building a different kind of relationship here. But
the golden rule. Put yourself in their shoes. If you had a lawyer, what would you want out of your lawyer?
It's like going to a car dealership, right? So if you go to like the really shitty, you know, Kia dealership. And, you know, or you go to, actually, I don't know what the other end of this would be, because I've had fancier cars and I don't know that I really got treated any better. But I always heard people say, if you go to Lexus, they have like a really nice waiting room with like an espresso machine. And I'm thinking, like, I think the only reason you're there is because your car's broken down. Yeah. But so I don't know. But it's like anything else. Like, what do you want? Like, when you go to a hotel, how do you want to be treated?
Yeah.
You know, when I go to a hotel for my anniversary and someone says, hey, happy anniversary, Mr. Chopin, I'm like, hey, that's nice. What a nice thing to do. Thank you. And I remember that. I went to a seminar that talked about this. And they called it unreasonable hospitality.
Yeah.
You know, and it was the guy speaking owned a restaurant in New York, and he won best restaurant in the world. And he wasn't a chef. And so the big deal is he was a restaurant owner, not a mm-hmm. chef. Everybody else are chefs. And he's like, what I did was I thought, like, what sort of hospitality could I provide at an unreasonable level to make this the most memorable event? He said, because diners, customers, they don't really remember the food, right? And it's true. Like, you go out to eat a lot, and you're young and you don't have kids yet, and so you're going out to eat. How often is it like, oh, I remember last year I went to that restaurant and I had that fish? Like every now and then, but really that's not it.
No, and that's
you
a good
remember
point.
How it made you feel.
The food, it fades. The memory of the fades. But if you go to a place where the service is terrible, you'll always
remember that.
You'll always remember
absolutely.
That.
Like we have a list. I'm like, I don't go there. I don't have time for that. Right? I mean, there's a restaurant in town for lunch that we go to sometimes, and somebody's like, you want to go to XYZ? And I'm like, oh man, that's gonna take forever. I don't have it in me to sit around for 2 hours for a salad, right? But I mean, you'll always remember the way they made you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not a restaurant. Like, we're not serving food and drinks here. But, you know, we do at least attempt to have that presence of mind and say, hey, like, what can I do for my clients that might make them feel more like a customer? Yeah. And I think, you know, but it starts with a phone call, at least, at a bare minimum. You know, you tell me, because I'm the outsider. Like, I'm at 32,000 feet, and I have the ability to walk around like, we have the best culture. Everyone's so happy here. What do you see?
Yeah, so it's a very tight-knit group. I think there's a really solid foundation of hires, of individuals who have similar backgrounds, similar moral compasses, and similar goals. And I think the morals and the goals, that's where it really comes into play, because everybody wants the same. Everybody wants to help lift each other up to achieve the same thing. It really does. It's the cliche, but it is a team here.
I like that. I think so, too.
Which can get lost at times where you're just trying to fill a timesheet and your firm is so big that, you know, you don't really have that kind of personal relationship with the other attorneys or staff. So here, you know, I've been fortunate enough at my last jobs to have some really excellent mentors. And because of some of those questions that I thought we were going to go over, I had to look up what mentor. And a simple definition is an experienced and trusted advisor. And that's great. But if you're not comfortable with that mentor to come and bring your possible stupid questions
right.
or stupid concerns, you're not going to get that advice or insight that, you know, you could have from somebody who has more experience than you and has been through it. So I think a huge thing here is, you know, it really is an open door office, and it is an office that people come into. So you have the people on site, everyone, again, similar morals, backgrounds, you're comfortable. You can ask them any question and they'll say, yep, I've actually experienced that. Go look in this case. And this is what I've run into. And so there's a really good opportunity here to just be a sponge and to soak up everybody else's experiences and knowledge. So I think that is, you know, definitely an improvement over here. And I think part of it is, you know, some of my past experiences, the mentors were there, they just might not have the time. And they wanted to help, but they just simply did not have the time.
You know, I find like a lot of those older guys too, like they think of themselves as mentors and they like the idea of it, mm-hmm. but they aren't as approachable as they think that they are. And they don't have the time that they may want to have or think that they have. And I learned very early in my career. So I always used to have like a very self-deprecating humor. That's just sort of like who I am. And I made like a very normal joke that I would make. And my boss at the time is one of those people that's like, he doesn't get that, right? And so if you make a joke about yourself in a deprecating way, he would be like, yeah, that's true. You're like, geez. And so I had to learn pretty quick, you know, that's like, okay, so never, it's just a very challenging atmosphere to be in, that you can't laugh at yourself, make jokes at yourself because they're too serious or they believe in themselves too much, right? I always say, like, don't believe your own bullshit too yeah. much, right? I mean, if you do, you're losing sight of what's really going on here. I think one of the reasons I think that our open door policy here works is because we're pretty young. We're very homogenous, not on purpose. It just mm-hmm. sort of organically happened that way. But you're right. We have very similar values and morals. But a lot of it is we're actually just kind of a young group of people.
Yeah.
And so my door is open. I leave my door open. And the only time I close it is if I'm on a Zoom call or something. And it's because I would rather be interrupted 100,000 times in a day and know that the team has the support that they need or that they know that I'm as engaged as they are than for you or someone else to feel like I don't have anyone to ask questions to. Or worse, make a mistake because you didn't want to ask, mm-hmm. right? And I don't have to worry about that with you. I know you're not out there making mistakes, but we have younger people. And so I would rather, I've said it 100,000 times here, even before you were here, I was like, I would rather you bug the shit out of me than to assume and make a mistake. So it's fine. I will leave my door open. Come on in. And sometimes I want to pull my hair out or whatever's left of my hair, you know, at this point. But I do think it's, you know, it's for a good cause, really, you know, right? I mean, being available. I think it helps the team kind of build that morale, too, where everyone feels comfortable. And so you can ask me dumb questions. It didn't bother me. Like, someone asked me a dumb question the other day. I was like, you know what? That is a dumb question, but it's not, because I remember in my 20s, I didn't know the answer to that question either. You know, and you know how I know the answer to that question? Because I got my, you know, teeth knocked in.
Yeah.
I learned the hard way.
Chewed out.
Yeah. Right. And so I was like, I know the answer because I learned the hard way. And sometimes learning the hard way is the best way, because you'll never make that mistake twice.
No, exactly.
So, all right. Well, I just actually just heard a ding, which I have a feeling is your next appointment. So I'll probably stay in here and hide. No, I'm kidding. maybe. Frankie, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Great catching up. Get out there and make your clients happy and giving them a lot of money so that I have a lot of money. I'm kidding. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today on Above the Legal Limit. If you enjoyed the show and you want to hear more about business and law, hit that subscribe button. If you didn't like the show, keep it to yourself. Remember, there's no limit to what we can achieve. We will see you next week. Until then, even though we're above the legal limit, let's drive safely. Cheers, everyone.